둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Yeah, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks as always for making your way here, checking out the series. Please do hit that subscribe button while you're hanging around. In fact, you do that, I'll give you three brand new interviews every single week, new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to keep you up to date on your favorite artists and discover some new ones at iTunes and Apple Podcasts, Spotify and Podchaser, NPR, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcasts from. Subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And that's me, Kyle Meredith, today talking with one of my musical heroes, the Cult's Ian Astbury. We're going to be discussing the new record, Under the Midnight Sun. He's going to talk about coming up as a crooner during the post-punk era, how journalists mistakenly lumping them in with hair metal, and living through the optics of nostalgia, as he says. We're also going to talk about some of the big influences on the album, including Brian Jones, late of the Rolling Stones, William S. Burroughs, Jack Kerouac and the Beats. And he's also going to dive into the ecological and environmental moments that arrive throughout. We're going to get his takes on recent artists like Yves Tumor and how they're part of this really bigger lineage of musicians that thread around Nico and the Velvet Underground and Andy Warhol and Pablo Picasso, too. All that and so much more. So enjoyed this conversation. We're talking Under the Midnight Sun. It's Kyle Meredith with Ian Astbury of The Cult.
Hi, Kyle.
Let me tell you, the new album, Under the Midnight Sun. I love you guys. I love this band so much. I always get excited. I think I had even a heightened excitement this time, which can be, you know, a good setup for letdown. And you did not do that. This album is so damn good.
Thank you.
By the way, your voice sounds great, too. I mean, as strong as ever. I was looking back and just looking at my favorite vocalists. And they all seem to have this, you know, what do you call it? Like a crooner style, which I think you
Yeah.
How did you
baritone.
Right. How did that develop? Because looking back and seeing that you all coming up sort of out of the punk world, I mean, that just had to feel so against the tide of the time.
Not really. I mean, Ian Curtis was a baritone. You know, he was emulating the lineage chain, everything from Paul Robeson through the blues artist, through Elvis Presley, through, I mean, even Perry Como, you know, and then Scott Walker, Jim Morrison. There's a certain space, you know, but Sinatra, Elvis, all those singers, they're all kind of crooner baritone singers. I mean, I love Serge Gainsbourg, I love Scott Walker, I love David Bowie. I mean, at one point, I was really in love with Peter Gabriel, but that's a completely different vocal register.
Did you find that you had to develop it in any way, or was that pretty natural then?
I never had any formal training. Well, that's not true. I was in school choir when I was a kid, but I was only a very short spurts of time, I was in school choir, I was about 10. But after that, I didn't really, there wasn't any school choirs or anything. I took music class, but probably singing to records was, you know, sing along with records, probably where it evolved from. And plus my parents were really, they had a few crooners in the room. Johnny Mathis, my mother loved Johnny Mathis. My father loved Paul Robes and he loved Deep Southern Gospel. You know, we were hearing, they always had pretty good record collection, my parents. So I was able to pick through that as a kid. And then I got a radio really early on. I was just a European radio. It was pirate radio. So we're getting all this kind of eclectic, more eclectic music in the early 70s. And then I guess when I came to North America as a kid, I was 11, going to Canada, all of a sudden my world opened. It was like FM radio, music from New York State. It's pretty profound. So it's always been around me. And I think because of that, it's just something I've done naturally since I was a kid.
Well, I love, yeah, just the way it's developed through the years and just the way you kind of carry on, you know, on top of sometimes some very abrasive rock sounds, you know, I mean, it's, that's such,
yeah,
it should be a contrast, you know, some, it shouldn't work, I guess. I mean, it has for, as you know, all these artists that you're talking about, it has for 50, 60, 70 years, but
I just love lot of those, a lot of those are individual performers, you know what I mean, as well. So it's kind of unique. I mean, perhaps with the exception of Morrison playing with the Doors, but when you're in a collaboration, the cult of collaboration, really. Mm-hmm. I don't even know it's a band, it's a collaboration between Billy and I, and we both have very different points of view and musical points of view, and where we meet is where the cult really works. So, you know, I might do vocal, I'll be the same vocalist, but in a different context, you'd hear me in a different context, like with On Call, for example. Those songs are much more crooned out. And I think on this record, I put two pieces of music in there, Vendetta X and I Threw Butterfly Heart. So I already have my vocal cadence set for that. A few of the songs, some of the choices, you know, not singing hysteronics, trying to keep the hysteria out of it. And all the, you know, the kind of, the inflections I would have used or when I was a kid, in my 20s, recording with Rick Rubin or whatever, I would have been completely different. I was a different person. And I honestly feel, I mean, I've tried to be conscious of evolving. You know, I wouldn't say, oh yeah, I don't pay attention to what I do, but I actually pay a lot of attention to what I do. And I try out different music. I try out different songs. I try and learn other music and other songs and other genres and work in other genres, which is more the intention going forward, is to be able to do a lot of the projects that I've been offered over the years that definitely are not cult centric.
Yeah, that's interesting then, you know, hearing how you talk about your styles and especially through the years and different projects, because I think it was one of the earlier interviews about this record with Billy, and he was saying that, you know, for him, this record had impressions of like Love and Dreamtime, like the earliest versions of cult. Like, I don't know if you felt that same way, but if so, vocally, does that have you going back to a certain spot then?
Different age, different diaphragm, different,
right,
fit, anatomically different,
like probably almost impossible to,
but in terms of a textural, there's definitely a turn to dark gothic futurist romanticist textured considered, you know, I mean, Billy's using the White Falcon in a way that's to create a soundscape, and it's not used as a weapon of aggression. You know, the guitars and a lot of, you know, people always assume guitar should be played at volume 11. Well, sometimes it's better if you play it at 3 and you get the tone. So the tone's really important. And I feel that in many ways, up until 1984, you know, we were in that pre-MTV moment, when we depended upon pretty much radio, a little bit of TV, but it's mostly word of mouth going to record stores, right? It's a completely different time. And there was way more of an underground scene happening. You know, there's a lot more discovery. You had to go, you couldn't just go on Spotify and look at a playlist and then discover everything all in one go. You had to dig through record bins. You had to ask your friends. I mean, so I feel that in this way, because a lot of the music I was listening to during this period, was listening to like Moody Mokhtar. I was listening to, you know, the music from Explosion from the sub-Saharan scene, which is incredible. And a lot of drone, everything from Black Rider to Sun. I was a lot of Can. In fact, you know, Amandul, not so much Amandul, probably more like Popol Vuh. And, you know, bits of Doors, to be honest with you. You know, the Doors really were able to get into that space, which is a completely different space than just writing a rock song. You know what I mean? Rock! I mean, the cult have been critiqued of being, well, you were hair man. You guys had hair. Well, yes, we had hair. But if you notice, who had us the hair first? And secondly, my hair was straight. I never poofed it out, boofed it out. And then we got to the point where we went, well, this is pretty much done. Everybody's in the room now. Heads got shaved. We didn't sit around. In fact, Billy was the first to shave his head. I eventually shaved mine about 94. It's like, that was so cathartic and so cleansing to do that. It's almost like we do not associate with this at all. And it's amazing when people in Super Me go like, so, you know, you guys are checking out the Motley Crue tour with Dev. I'm just like, excuse me? I don't even know how you can use these bands in the same sentence. The cult shouldn't even be the same. And that's said with all respect, because they do what they do. But we're lifers. I mean, I'm a lifer. I'll be doing this. It's all I know. It's what I love. I love music. Touring can be very interesting.
I always thought of you guys more in the, and also just broadly and to say the alternative scene from that time. But there's that line.
We're the counter narrative, that's for sure. I mean, we're always the counter narrative. You always get asked the assumed questions, and I'm always, nope. That's an assumption. There's a lot of, assumptions about the cult, but.
Well, that's that line in A Cut Inside. I mean, does that speak to that at all when you say, I don't want to be caught up in your scene, outsiders forever?
Yeah, bang on. That's a 17-year-old right there saying, I don't want to be part of that clique. Please don't associate me with it. Yeah, totally.
What is the follow-up line there, Ghost of Our Lives, what is that reference?
Which one? Oh, Ghost of Our Lives?
Yeah.
Nostalgia. Yeah. You know, living through the optics of nostalgia constantly. Well, especially when it's actually, you know, consider for us, was constantly thrust upon us. You know, you're defined by what you did in 1980. Sometimes I get defined by what I did in with Southern Death Cult, you know, or even working with the Doors. So Ghost of Our Lives is really a reference to nostalgia. And it's the phrase that came up, it's the phrase that fits, and that's what I'm referencing, is there's a consciousness about nostalgia, not operating from a nostalgic point of view, but when somebody's trying to make sense of you, they're always going to use things they know or reference points they know, but ultimately I'm coming from a completely different perspective, obviously, because being the principal creator, one of the principal creators of this, we're inside of it, so we have a completely different perspective.
And don't go anywhere, we'll be right back.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Ian Astbury of The Cult. I did love hearing that line. And you know, maybe it was a press release or something. You know, when you're talking about just some of the other artists you had in mind and the beats come up, you know, Burroughs was in there. And I've been such a big fan of them forever, too. I mean, I'm sitting right by stacks of their books, probably within
Short Circuit Control. That was Burroughs' whole thing and Brian Geisen's whole thing. Short Circuit Control. Be the counter narrative, break it up, cut it up. And that's something that I've been, you know, I think the gateway to all of that really was, the gateway was actually reading Jack Kerouac very early on. You know, I mean, like at 18, reading Kerouac, especially Dharma Bums, Subterraneans, Big Sur, On the Road, not, strangely, On the Road, not as much so. But you know, Tristesse is one of my favorite books, Kerouac, and his interest in Buddhism, and Ginsberg's interest in Buddhism, and Alan Watts' interest in Buddhism, and that whole moment where they were looking at different philosophies, different ideas, and different ways of seeing and perceiving, you know, Geisen's cut-up techniques, Morocco, Marrakesh, which actually led me and this record through into not only Burroughs and Geisen, but Brian Jones, and Brian Jones as this angelic Gabriel who went and captured the music of the master musicians of Jujuka and brought it back. I mean, don't forget that the Rolling Stones did make Satanic Majesty's Request.
Right.
And Satanic Majesty's Request, what an incredible title. That's worthy of its own, I mean, God, that's worth of its own, you know, wing of a museum or a 10-volume dissertation on the whole thing. Break it. It's like, what? What are you guys talking about? What's going on here? Brian Jones with a sitar in his hand? Brian Jones at Monterey Park with Nico and Jimi Hendrix, dressed in Moroccan robes. Brian Jones in Marrakesh with Geisen and Burroughs. What? How old was he then? About 25? You know, we forget our savants. We forget our unicorns. And I honestly feel Brian Jones has been overlooked and deserves some real serious exploration. Because you think about the music he was bringing to the Stones then, and we have this music coming out of the sub-Saharan scene, Sahel Sounds, I believe it's called Sahel or Sahel Sounds in Portland. They've been bringing in a lot of artists and musicians from Mali, Nigeria, and I'm actually performing on a Moroccan rug every night. Everything has a purpose and a frequency in this band. You know, there's an intention with everything. There's an intention with every line. There's an intention with every nuance. I mean, it all comes with intention and consciousness. That's another why I feel we fall between the cracks in a lot of spaces. People don't want to touch it. You know, it's, this is a bit, we don't really understand what's going on here. So we're just going to leave it over here. You know, it's an anomaly. We're an anomaly in that way. But by the same token, no better than, no less than. We're no better than anybody. We're no less than anybody. We're just doing what we do. And we're out here doing it now.
It almost makes sense because the first words we hear on this album, am I right? You're whispering, forget what you know.
Yeah, forget what you know. Which is, again, to do with nostalgia and pre-pandemic and certainly where we are in terms of the polarization of society and environmental or the geopolitical, social political. See, today one of the pipelines exploded with natural gas.
Oh, right.
It's pushing so much into the ether. It ain't going to be good. It's not a good one. It's almost like a nuclear event for an environmental situation. So where do we go with that? Do you weave that into your... It's a rhetorical question. I mean, what did I do with it? I used it. It's all in the record. It's all in there. More should be revealed. There's a few Easter eggs I threw around for fun for people to look at various. There's actual geo coordinates sprinkled out throughout the cult's artwork, and it's down to the. You may or may not want to Google on that geo coordinate. But if you do, it's a clue. It's an insight. I'm not going to do all the work, for God's sakes.
No, I heard about that. I think somebody said on some part of your merch, even there was some coordinates that.
Geo coordinates. Just started putting that on. I was fascinated with map reading when I was a kid. I was in the military when I was a kid, and I was always loved maps. So, and going through the Himalayas, in Tibet, you know, you're looking at maps, and I love. Looking at topography and maps. I don't know if that's a fetish or something.
Well, I mean, and sometimes, you know, it's not even hidden. I mean, you've got that line in there, and give me mercy. I mean, the end of our species, like that's a heavy line. Just
it's the end of it. It's the end of a species.
Ah.
So, and you could read it as the end of our species, but the end of a species happens every 15 minutes or something.
Sure.
Watching... I had a breakdown on tour about 3 days ago where I was just sitting there and I was looking at an ocean on a graphic image of a dolphin with a blue whale, and they were kind of just hanging out together. And I was looking at it, and it just ripped me apart. And then you come in cities where people are living on top of each other, and the lack of consciousness, the lack of self, the peripheralation of self, me, I. Oh, I don't care about what these guys, you know. We are so beyond even having the luxury of talking about polarized political views. At that point, that is ghosts. You're talking about things that have already occurred. How is that possibly going to move it forward? And when you see the reality of what's going on and you travel, I think it's the perspective we get is because we travel so much. So you get to see certain, if you're not feeling this, when you really ain't going to feel this, you travel around and you just see it reinforced and reinforced and reinforced and reinforced. And these polarized narratives reinforced. Lack of communication. Give me mercy in a new language. It's a plea. Give me mercy.
And then for the record to basically end with, you know, for all the setup in that title track, you know, there ends up being a warning in that too, because that title track, it almost sounds like, you know, this Eden type of poetry that you're talking about, but then you say, and it'll all fade in time.
No, it's very, very Blake. Well, all does fade in time. Everything devolves. Everything's impermanent. And in our culture, we just want things to live forever. I mean, if you're dead, you get stuffed, or you get a hologram made of you or whatever. You know, or there's a certain narrative that's pushed by interested parties who want to sell a certain product, or, you know, the way a lot of streaming services have been built, have been on the ghosts of, you know, everyone who built it from day one, all the R&B artists, all the blues artists, all the rock artists, all the hip hop artists. I mean, look at the graveyard. It's incredible. And the machine just keeps on rolling. So this isn't a complaint. It's purely an observation. I mean, and then take or leave it, because most folks, they're going to do what they're going to do anyway. You can just do you. The best possible thing is do you.
It really is beautifully done. I mean, for the bleakness of everything we're talking about, you know, it's as far as rock and roll music goes, it's really beautifully done.
Well, thank you very much. But in terms of bleakness, it's not so much bleakness as fact and truth and actually lived experience. So there's two choices. One is to put your head in the sand, or one is to really think about, how can I contribute to, give me a shovel, start digging. Where do I start digging? Where do I start? What should I be doing? I have very limited time here. I mean, a lot of my, you know, ideas are, I guess, an evolution of spending nearly 4 years around Buddhist teachings and communities and indigenous teachings and communities as a principal influence source. I mean, watching the sunset on Everest or standing in the Potala Palace, being admonished by the Dalai Lama for being late, sitting in sweat ceremonies, you get a different frequency, you get a different information, you get a different perspective. And that's, again, it's neither better than nor less than. It's just what's inquisitive. Maybe because I was an immigrant kid, I had to learn about my environment really quickly. I mean, I was an immigrant, so I was actually an immigrant of a parent who was a refugee of World War II. So immigrant child of a refugee parents. I can identify with that. I guess that was an authentic description, because my father suffered terrible PTSD from being bombed, literally bombed, you know, and being a child and living through that, my God. And that was inflicted upon us, certainly in our household, but so was our whole community where I grew up. Here it is, you know. So we're not that far from Orwellian 1984, but that is the year the band was born. Crass referred to it as year zero. A lot happened in 84, the LA Olympics, an incredible Ridley Scott commercial for the first Apple computer.
Right. I remember that one.
Yeah, 1984. I mean, just after Blade Runner, but it's a sweet spot. It's a real sweet spot. And we got off to play in the opening day of the Olympics in Los Angeles, you know, dripping wet, probably about 150 pounds, scrawny, you know, no luggage, just feral kids from post-punk scene, arriving in LA and just blown away by the sunshine and the light and the space. I went straight to Pasadena and played Perkins Palace that day. That was incredible. That was incredible. So we have that in our DNA. And yeah, there's been times when we've had our shirts off, you know. Mm-hmm. You're 27, what are you going to do? it's a moment. It's a moment. Shirts stay on now. But we're not in that bad shape. Clean up pretty good. You know. But the content is really, you know, what the conversation, I mean, we could go into the psychedelic conversation, which is another theme that definitely weaves itself through. There is a psychedelic component to this record. I'm referencing Ram LZ, the artist, the musician. Ram LZ coined the term Gothic Futurism. And that really, but that was back in 84, maybe he came up with that, early 80s. But I really feel something that's about that period from just from post-punk, probably when the Sex Pistols split up, when it became Public Image into Joy Division into, and then what was happening in New York with electro and hip hop. And the fact that Afrika Bambaataa did play with John Lydon and Malcolm McLaren was involved in that. There was this magical transference of energy, not from the coasts in the United States, but from London to New York. And it was based on post-punk and reggae. Reggae was in there as well, because we were all around reggae artists as punks. In fact, they were our first benefactors. They took care of us. We played in their clubs. In Sudden Death Cult, my first audience was about, we played above, we rehearsed above a reggae shop called Roots Records in Bradford. So our first audience was Rastafarians. So all that energy was always there. So we felt very close to Rastafarians. We felt very close with even Krishnas to a degree, a lot of the outsider groups. And then that, through McLaren, going to the Bronx, seeing Bambaataa and everything that was happening already happening there, and then in making Buffalo Gals, and the scene started exploding, and obviously Cookie Puss and the Beasties and Rick and the whole thing. So in terms of creative, you know, that's now been transposed into the fashion world. I mean, that culture is now, when kids are buying Supreme, they're buying that, you know, it's built on that. And when, you know, hip hop generations are built on that, but it wasn't straight up. Just straight out of the Bronx. It was coming out of different areas and perspectives, and you know, and it evolved in that way. So it was really interesting. And I honestly feel we're in a moment now where it's kind of not some, there's this Southern Spain, Northern African connection through London into New York. Los Angeles has its own thing with you know, Latino, right down from Los Angeles all the way down to the Amazon, the pyramids and very unique indigenous cultures in the Americas, all linking up, you know, and our influences from the West Coast. It's a really amazing time for music. And then there's the dark wave. It's coming from Berghain in Berlin, you know. There's this, like, Heilung are playing at the Greek, you know, Rammstein are playing at the Rose Bowl. It's like, what? These are huge venues. People are flocking to these events. You've got, you know, like Eve's Tumor, you've got Ethel Cain, you know, you've got artists around the kind of dark wave, like the Black Rider. You've got so many, Sun, Southern Lord, Sergeant House, King Woman, this whole area of music, Gothic Futurism. And there's definitely a connective tissue between that and Year Zero 84. And then you can flip that back to Brian Jones and Geisen and what they were doing in North Africa. There's a natural lineage, even with the Yves Saint Laurent or Pablo Picasso or, you know, Warhol. I mean, we're dining at their tables. We are dining at their tables. They built this and we forget, and that's unfortunate. But when you actually, if you have any time to crack open Wild Boys or Junkie or even some Bukowski, I mean, Bukowski.
Yep.
I met him once. And that was sensational to have to be, you know, to stand that close to the man and have a conversation with him. But you know, your life is your life. You do not be clubbed into dank submission. Excuse me. Do not be clubbed into dank submission.
It's a great line. It's a great line. And I love the electricity that just went all through the world and time as you traced all of that together. That's incredible.
Well, you know, I mean, that's only part of it. That's part of it because there's so many other players in the room. I mean, God, you know, the cult, some death cult. We opened for Bauhaus, see Nico with Bauhaus, then seeing Nico in a club. I'm lighting a cigarette for her. This is the woman that was the muse, not only the muse, I mean, she was powerful. But Morrison, Brian Jones, were all blessed by her, you know. So the lineage coming through that, just even being with Nico for that moment. And then fast forward about 8 years later, I'm in an elevator in London in a hotel, and who's in the elevator with me? The rest of the Velvet Underground. My son and I got into an elevator with, you know, Maureen Tucker, Sterling Morrison, John Cale, and Lou Reed. They were the only other four people in the elevator. And then the next day we were going down and John Lydon walks out with Bill Siddons, who used to manage the Doors. So it put it all together. I don't know. It is what it is. And as a wise man once said, that in a quarter will get you a cup of coffee.
It's a good place probably to wrap this up too, because I'll take that cup of coffee a million times over. I will, happily.
Excellent.
Ian, Under the Midnight Sun is so much fun to listen to. It's so beautiful. And I love digging into it with me. Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk about it. This is always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to speak with you.
Now, the last time I talked with Ian was back in 2019, and that was another epic conversation, too. Back then, we were talking about the 1989 album Sonic Temple, not only its big rock sound, but also its DNA that intersects with Joy Division and The Doors, Def Jam, more of the beat authors, the art side of NYC, and then the developing Seattle scene. So I wanted to include that one here for you as well as for part two of Kyle Meredith with Ian Astbury of The Cult.
Hi, Kyle. This is Ian Astbury calling.
Let's see. 30 years of Sonic Temple. It's about to get its big box set release and the ongoing tour along with this. 1989, man. This is quite a while ago. I guess you've had to jump back in this record to get ready for the tour, right?
To a degree. I mean, we have been playing some of the songs since they were recorded. There's probably like maybe two or three that we haven't played in our set. And we've definitely pulled songs out for a while. We pulled out songs like Fire Woman, retired them for a couple of years. Songs like Edie, we retired for a few years just to try and keep it fresh, you know. But the intention of this was really, it was kind of twofold. One is that I think at the very core, The Cult is a live performance-driven band. And we really grew up coming out of club scene into, you know, post-punk, post-modern alternative period, into kind of evolved into a, you know, went through a phase of, well, I wouldn't say it was a phase, DNA of, you know, psychedelic and harder rock music, blues-based rock music, and then back into sort of postmodern meandering into that. So we've kind of, you know, meandered through the past 30 years. And the intention of this was to continue that as a live band. That's what your principal function is in many ways, and everything that, you know, implies. And then the other idea was that Beggars Banquet, who are a mother record label in the UK, you know, they wanted to do a reissue of the album. And I've never been a great nostalgist or a great celebrator of anniversaries. I mean, I think this is the very first time that The Cult as an entity has come out and said, we're supporting, acknowledging 30 years of this band, you know, for the first time. And in some ways, we wanted to use Sonic Temple as a platform to link to the DNA of The Cult. You know, it's a very, very important record in The Cult's canon. And we wanted to acknowledge not only the songs on that record, but the influences and how they've kind of continued throughout the last whatever amount of years it's been. I'm not keeping count.
I'm glad you did. I'm glad you are taking that moment, too, because, it isn't just one of the most important in your own catalog. I think this is one of the most important records of the 80s, and it did show, and I should say beyond the 80s, just the fact that it came out in the 80s. But because of what you were saying there, you all had done so many different styles leading into this record, and maybe this, yes, as it's been written, was one of the first times you sort of doubled down, because Electric, I guess, had kind of started in that direction. Not that the two records sound alike, but it kind of was the first time you said, yeah. You said, all right, let's go further that direction. Why was that?
I think it was just a desire to continue to grow, to not repeat ourselves. That was very important. And also to really kind of explore guitar-based, guitar-driven record, explore that side of ourselves a little bit more, because it was something that was really blossoming in a live set. You know, when we first started out, we had pretty much two drum beats, a tribal beat and a 4/4/4 and a 4 beat, you know, like everybody else at the time, because we all came out of punk rock. Nobody could play. And that was a very easy beat to play.
Right.
And everything was derivative of, I guess, you know, Peter Hook, because he wrote these incredible melodies in Joy Division. And everybody was like, look at what they did. You know, we can apply that to what we do. So we kind of evolved out of that. And at that time, you know, if you look at the images or you know anything about the band, Sudden Death Cult, Theater of Hate, mm-hmm. that period, it was a really interesting time. It was almost like, you know, Britain was in a very, it was in a political upheaval. You know, the campaign for nuclear disarmament was in full swing. It was just pre-1984. It was just pre-Orwellian. You know, there was a band called Crass who were doing a countdown every album. They would do, you know, like 4 years to 1984, 3 years to 1984. And then they split up in 1984, kind of signifying in many ways that 1984 was year zero. You know, it was like the end of the 20th century and kind of the beginning of the 21st century. So I guess in some ways, seeing a lot of this culture was being discarded after the post-punk and punk movement, which kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater in many ways, you know, like blues music kind of went away for a minute and as a major influence in rock music. And something was all very important to me. And we wanted to incorporate that more into it. And plus the psychedelic influences, you know, psychedelic in the broadest terms, everything from Pink Floyd to even the Gun Club, you know, who were sort of had a psychedelic, certainly a desert peyote essence, you know, what Jeffrey was conjuring up. So we were just making it up as we went along. There was no rules. And when people told us there was rules, it's like, absolutely not. I mean, when we made the transition from death cult to the cult, people were like, what? What are you guys doing? It was like, we're done with that. That's finished. We've done it. And the whole movement was kind of, it was fizzling out. And there was so much more happening. MTV was coming up. And 1984 was the year that Ridley Scott did the Olympic commercial with the girl throwing a javelin. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very Orwellian, dystopian, you know, people at the desk and this javelin. And we arrived at LA in 1984, the opening day of the Olympics. So it's kind of like the beginning of Apple, beginning from computers, the beginning. We could sort of see the 21st century coming. And the 60s seemed so far away. And it was such a taboo to dive into 60s music. But there were these kind of fringe clubs in London where everybody would gather. And I mean everybody. You'd see like everybody from, you know, Jeffrey Lee Pierce to Blitzer Bargeld to Susie Sue to Robert Smith. They all played this club called Alice in Wonderland, which was a psychedelic rock club. And all they played was everything probably like, I want to say 65 through 71. But it was really choice psychedelic cuts, like a lot of great British bands. I mean, what Nick Mason is doing right now with Saucer Full mm-hmm. of Secrets mm-hmm. was kind of the essence of the club. And it was an incredible energy because it was like so unlike anything else that was happening in art and music at that time, because it wasn't so much revisionist. It was just like, I guess, the archetypal elements of, you know, the late 60s and the early 70s rock bands, what they were. They were seemed to be much more connected to the soil and the ether. You know, there were the information was coming in through a different channel. It wasn't coming through the internet. It wasn't coming through the phones. You had to actually go out and experience it. Like a lot of the songs were written through travel. You'd go to a place and then you'd be inspired. And, you know, you weren't sitting at home imagining what it'd be like through a book or a computer. You know, you'd go see it through your own eyes. And I think it was just a continuation for the cult. So, yeah, I mean, I was always pushing for something new, something different, something fresh. And Sonic Temple was a moment where, I guess, a lot of things converged, a lot of influences converged. And, you know, we were very aware of what was happening in Seattle. We'd had a relationship with Seattle since, like, 85, 86. We played the Paramount Theater in Seattle. Seashell Sanctuary was a top 40 hit in Seattle, which was mm-hmm. strange because the rest of the country, it wasn't. It's more of a college situation. College radio and like people like K-Rock were playing it. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot in it. Yeah. There's a lot in it.
So I was going to kind of seg there for a second too, because Fire Woman ended up in the movie Singles, you know, based in Seattle with Cameron Crowe there. So genre, as we're kind of hitting around here, was really important back then. We talk about it differently today than we did back then. Like when you in the fan scene, you were either
a punk or a metalhead or a goth or, you know, an alternative, whatever.
It was way more, it was far more niche.
Right.
It was far more niche.
But the cult seemed to be the bridge to do, you know, be on tour with Metallica and also to be accepted by the Seattle guys, you know, in this coming of age movie that's meant a lot to that scene too. What did that look like to you at that moment? Did you see it like that?
It was kind of strange because we, like I said, you know, coming through post-punk punk scene, you're coming more out of an urban environment. I mean, we came out of London. The band was formed in Brixton. You know, our neighbor Nick Cave lived around the corner. You know, The Clash lived close. Cosmo Vinyl, the guys who worked with the Clash and Flea, the Road Crew, they all lived in vicinity, proximity to where we lived, you know. So we didn't, I don't think we're that self-conscious. It was really more about like discovering the new music that was coming up and just really fans. I mean, going to see bands play, like seeing Soundgarden at the Lingerie in 1988 or seeing Mother Love Bone before they came Pearl Jam, got close to Andrew, got close to Chris Cornell, seeing those guys. And they had very similar ideology. I mean, you know, it would have been very interesting to see what would happen with Mother Love Bone had they continued with Andrew, because they were way more glam. I mean, they were... Mm-hmm. We saw them opening to Dogs the More. You know, they were like really glam rock. I mean, it was more like T-Rex. It was more like Freddie Mercury. You know, like Queen mixed with punk. I mean, it was very interesting music. And it was so incredibly exciting and dangerous, you know, because you go out in the street dressed in your finery, you're an immediate target for, you know, any kind of negative attention. So, I mean, we were traveling all over the world as well. So, and plus our history, our lineage, Sudden Death Cult, I was opening for the Clash, Bauhaus. You know, we did shows with New Order, festivals, you know, festivals with Nick Cave on the bill. Gun Club was on the bill, you know, and then it just kind of evolved. The scene kind of evolved. It kind of, I think psychedelic music, psychedelic rock, probably the Doors was a very important connected tissue, because the Doors really go, you talk about a bridge. The Doors really had everything in there. They had like hard blues. They had, you know, at times it could be hard rock and, you know, folk, Spanish, flamenco. Mm-hmm. You know, classical, jazz. I mean, with so many, you know, some of the songs were very brutal, completely brutal, pagan, primal. And then some of the songs were incredibly sophisticated. And then they have moments of absolute beatific. You know, they really reached the zenith. They did grab the sun, you know. And that, I think, they were such an important band. I know in Liverpool in 1980, one of the bands that was most influential, and you could see that in like Echo and the Bunnymen, for example.
Right. Yeah, of course.
And Teardrop Explodes was the Doors. The Doors were a very, very important band in 1980, post-apocalypse now. So, you know, that was kind of an indicator, I think, for a lot of where we were going, because we were kind of like, I guess the guidebooks were the biographies that were written. We were and meeting people in the flesh. I mean, we opened for Iggy Pop in, I don't know, what, 86, 87. Then we went and opened for Bowie. And then we, you know, we did a tour with GNR opening for us. And that was an incredible year for you know, talking about diverse crisscrossing genres. I think it really changed when MTV decided to come up with 120 minutes, Headbangers Ball, Yo MTV Raps. They really began to segregate the genres, which wasn't the truth, because when we were making Electric with Rick Rubin, we were immersed in the Def Jam world, in their universe, you know, and were always hanging out with whomever was around, you know, like meeting LL Cool J when he was 19, or, you know, hanging out with the Beasties, or just being around. Hip-hop and rock were way more together. In fact, the cult, I think 3 years ago, we did a couple of shows with Public Enemy, which really, to me, made a lot of sense. I think it's just really, ultimately, the bonding factor is fans of music, you know. And then somebody says, well, actually, you have your own fans. You'd be like, what? How's that possible? I'm busy focused on getting the music, going to the shows. I mean, I still have a voracious appetite to discover new music. It's just what's in the day, and that's what gets me out of bed, is when you hear an artist who's really engaged in what in their craft, and they're doing it in a fully focused, fully realized way, you know, with no apparent agenda other than to make an excellent piece of work. And I don't know what the inspiration is. For example, you know, Tom York's Anima, which I love. It's a genius. He's a brilliant man, an incredibly sensitive man, and admire him greatly. There's so many great records have been made, like, you know, Tyler's Igor, brilliant. You know, Billie Eilish is amazing. You know, there's so many incredible artists right now. Like, we were them at some point in our career. We were like, you know, teens, evolving into young men, evolving into, you know, adult males. And we grew up on the road, traveling around capital cities throughout the world, you know. And by the time we were 25 or 26, we were pretty burnt, you know. And you know, we were reading "No One Here Gets Out Alive," one of the Bibles that were floating around, and then eventually getting to meet Danny Sugarman and be immersed in the world of the Doors with Manzarek and Krieger, and you know, and then going forward. But in many ways, that record was kind of like the tent pole that connected so many different areas, which was evident when we did Gathering of the Tribes, mm-hmm. because that was kind of like an opportunity for me to say, here's some context as to where I think it's at. And a lot of people seem to agree with it, perhaps not consciously, but certainly in terms of the energy of what, you know, we were trying to create with Gathering of the Tribes. In many ways, it was a window, again, you know, a gateway into the 21st century. So.
And you nailed it. I mean, it was perfectly on, you know, on the spot, you know, everybody that was a part of that.
It was amazing, very quickly, because, I mean, I came up with the idea in Rapid City, South Dakota. We were opening for Metallica. Out of that and the love affair with Indigenous American culture and what was happening in the media, MTV, Life magazine had just done a piece on what, you know, subcultures are going to look like going into the 1990s. They were telling us, the marketers were telling us what it's going to be like. We were no longer telling people what it was going to be like, you know, the audience. And we're being told, I mean, that the advertising agencies and the marketers and the, you know, the A&R people got incredibly sophisticated. They became embedded with artists and they began to influence almost like Jesuits or something, you know. They came into these communities of like raw creatives and started to influence their commercial doctrine. And, you know, so kind of saw it coming. It felt very Machiavellian and sinister in what MTV were trying to do, you know, to cut up, right? You're getting segregated now. Yo MTV Raps and 120 Minute, you know, Headbangers Ball, you guys are separate. It's like, well, wait a minute, we're not, you know, right. We're not separate. We're all the same age. We may come from different backgrounds or different environments, but we've definitely got a lot in common with each other. So I saw that coming and I was like, that doesn't feel right. That we have to kind of grab our community back, our musical community. And of course, you know, inspired by so many things. Going to Live Aid was a huge inspiration in 1985, being at Live Aid, sitting between Bob Geldof and Billy Connolly when Queen were on stage in one of the boxes overlooking the stadium. How can that not be an influence on, right. on a 24-year-old, you know, 25-year-old kid? Actually, no, I was young. I was 23. I mean, that blew my mind. I could never seen anything like that before. The response, the audience response, the visceral energy was just profound. And the unity and the sense of shared cause, you know, cause, C-A-U-S-E, not cause, the artist, K-A-W-S. Yeah, but, you know, it's hard to kind of put into, I mean, that one of the things for the cult is it's always been people sit down and go like, you guys are full of contradictions. And go like, yeah, I guess we are. You know, it's like, yeah, constantly. You know, I love that. There's a great interview with David Bowie where the interviewer says, I think it might be Russell Hart, he says to him, says, isn't that pretentious? And Bowie just turned around and goes like, I've always been pretentious, darling, you know? And that was the kind of attitude. It's like, yeah, it's contradictory. We are contradictory. That we're not doing it as a shtick. There's an absolute sincere passion for music and culture and film and art and photography and acting and all the crafts, all the visual arts, painting. There's a convergence of energy. I mean, we came of age at a time when we went to New York in 84 when Warhol and Basquiat were still active, you know, and we dropped into that. We played, the first gig we played in New York was at the Danceteria, and it was a Puerto Rican dance night, a Puerto Rican party, and there was all these Puerto Rican kids staring at us going like, what is this? This isn't our music. And we were like, sorry, we got booked this night. This is it. But it was amazing to be immersed into that, you know, into that diversity, into that, you know, how complex it became in terms of cultural diverse images. And I was always breaking off to try and see artists like John Lee Hooker or Jerry Lee Lewis or Chuck Berry or, you know, whomever you could grab, these great iconic unicorns, you know, Bob Dylan as well at the time, you know, to see them perform and how magnificent they were, you know, just in terms of raw energy. And, you know, it was just exhilarating. And that's kind of what keeps me going, I guess, in some ways, is discovery, you know, just a voracious appetite for being inquisitive. And a lot of times you come up against people that will tell you, individuals that will tell you how it should be, and that you've crossed over some lines which you shouldn't be crossing over. And it's like, well, who are you to say? What's your credentials? You know, what are your credentials? Please, please. What are you basing this upon? It's not a science project.
Jorge Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
You know, you hit New York there, and I knew that was kind of important going into this record. That I should note that that same year that you all put out Sonic Temple, you were also on Debbie Harry's record, backing her up on the Love Light. Speaking of New York, it's hard to get more New York than that.
No, that was kind of strange how that came about. I think it was Rodney Bingenheimer introduced me to Chris and Debbie, and they were making – Debbie was doing a record with Mike Chapman, I believe, producing. It was very important because he produced a lot of British glam bands like Sweet, stuff like that. So a great British producer, lauded producer, and it was really interesting being around Chris and Debbie. I mean, an incredibly charismatic couple and incredibly high level of emotional intelligence, certainly authentic. And I was always looking for mentorship. In some ways, I always really enjoyed meeting artists who were a little bit older than me, mm-hmm. that had more experience. And I just asked them 1,000 questions. I just was always interested in, I still am, the opportunity to sit down with any artist and who's had a decent amount of time in it and done a good body of work, and you ask them questions, how do they maintain that harmonic balance between creativity and washing the dishes, you know? It's like, I'm going to be a student. I'll be a student till the day I die. I don't definitely haven't mastered the craft yet, but yeah, it's like you're always in pursuit of that perfect piece, and then you make something you think's really good, and then you listen to it over and over and over again, and you're like, this could change. I should have done it that way. But then you're into something else. So, you know,
right.
Just keep moving. And that's, I guess, one of the lessons I picked up along the road was like, don't drive the car looking in the rearview mirror. You know? If you're constantly looking at the past for your answers, you're going to get stuck because the environment's changed. The way we communicate has changed. Being present in the present moment is the real gift, to be able to receive the information and put it through your own filter. And there's an incredible amount of creativity happening right now. You know, it's just everybody is doing something creative. I don't know anybody, certainly in my circle of friends, who are not creatives. All the different stages of career development, you know, some people have been around for a while, some people are just coming up, all in different fields as well. Mm-hmm. You know, photography, art, filmmaking, music, fashion. But they all share the same passion and a desire to create and a desire to make the world a better place as well, a desire to address what is happening environmentally. In society, you know, everyone seems to be really motivated to get this thing together. And I think that was one of the ideals of the late 60s generation, certainly Jim Morrison, was a sense of communion, unity, ritual space, you know, and create an energy that can transcend, you know, this Western industrial complex conditioning that we're all get stuck in. And I'm very excited about what's happening, especially on the West Coast. The West Coast is on fire right now in terms of the energy in LA is incredible. I lived in New York for in the 80s, the 90s, and the aughts, and you know, for different periods of time. Last time I lived there for nearly 4.5 years, and New York was until you know the glass and concrete went up and rents became insane. New York was it. New York was Mecca, but LA, I guess a lot of refugees from New York and other cultural capitals started to gravitate towards LA because it was a lot cheaper, easier, you know, cheaper lives. It's definitely changing now, but there's so many galleries, there's so many events. I mean, you're spoiled for choice, Like in my immediate vicinity, I live between the Hollywood Bowl and the Fonda Theater. Just, you know, there's so much going on.
Yeah, when I heard, I talked to Kim Gordon not too long ago, when I heard that, you know, she had left New York for LA and was doing just as much art out there, I was like, oh yeah, no, that's, you could tell that's part of the sea change right there.
That's a telltale sign.
Absolutely. And that's wonderful because Kim Gordon's a visionary creative, and I really like her paintings. I think her paintings are excellent.
Absolutely.
Actually, during when we did Sonic Temple, we were doing a TV show, like a filmed interview. I'm not quite sure where it was, but I was there in like all the dope clothes I was wearing at the time, like, you know, totally done out. And they walked out of this interview situation, and I was like, oh, wow, such an honor to meet you guys. I love Daydream Nation. And I was just really, you know, I was pretty struck that they were standing right in front of me because I really admire them. And then when the interviewer sat down and said, yeah, I showed them the Firewoman video. I said, did you like it? They were like, no. And I was like, oh, that was a drag. But then again, I understood. I understood why that might not fit in with their, you know, their view of culture and what it should be. But I think right now we've got to get into a place where artists, anybody who's doing something creative, we unify, that there's not this kind of, Jesus Christ, intellectual bullying going on. You know, nobody knows more than anybody else. If you're sensitive in any way, you can learn so much from other people and just listen. And, you know, there's always a different perspective, and it can enhance your own perspective, your own lifestyle, and affect very positively in a way around you. I used to go out my way to go into environments that were, you know, supposedly off limits. Like during Sonic Temple tour, the rave culture was coming up in the UK, and I was going out to clubs, rave clubs and events. The energy was incredible, and the music was changing as well, shifting. You know, Stone Roses were on the horizon, and Happy Mondays and Charlatans and Spiral Carpets. Primal Scream were doing incredible work, still are. It's a really vibrant scene. Bands like The Orb, you know, just pre-Massive Attack. It was such an exciting time to go out, and that's where the energy was. And I remember going to the Hacienda. Pete Hook actually took me to the Hacienda, and I was like dressed in like leather pants and cowboy hat, you know. And I walked in, I was only like 26 or something, and I walked in and I felt so old. I was like, what is this? Everyone's wearing like, you know, dope haircuts, sneakers, and I was like, this is like New York. It's just jamming, it's rammed, it's, the energy was incredible. So I'd be sneaking off to these clubs and then going on stage and performing, you know, with the Cult, and then hitting whatever joint we could find, you know, 3, 4, 5 in the morning, and just immersing ourselves in that, kind of hip hop shows, you know. We used to blast NWA through the PA before we went on stage every night, you know. It's like, we're going to set a tone here. This is something we're really into. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, I guess, a lot of context around the Cult that haven't really, well, I think we're getting more into it now, because we're getting to more, there's a little bit of revisionism going on right now, you know. People are going, they did it first. And they're like, well, actually, not quite. They did it after a lot of other people did a lot of incredible work. I mean, nobody has the right to any real estate, cultural real estate in this. Everyone's been influenced by somebody, and that's okay. It's completely healthy to be open to other information than what you deem as, you know, what's going on in your head. It just continues. It continues.
It's not hard to draw, you know, the line from, you know, you all listening to NWA to what, how The Witch ended up sounding.
Of course.
With the drum loops and stuff like that. Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
It's not brain science. You know, it's not brain surgery. You know, I mean, yeah, Rick Rubin produced the track. Matt Dyke, who did Paul's Boutique, who was a brilliant producer. In fact, we cut that track. He cut the beats, and I used to hang out in Matt's studio, and in Matt's studio, Santa Monica Boulevard, were Basquiat's lined up against the wall. All these, because he was friends with Jean-Michel.
Yeah, wow.
So it was all incredible Basquiat. So that was made in that environment, this funky studio on Santa Monica Boulevard, surrounded by Basquiat. And wow, the beats kind of came from that, and another song that appeared in 1994 called Naturally High. But that was it. We just wanted to get that, the street sound. I mean, both Billy and I grew up in some pretty rough industrialized neighborhoods at various times of our lives. You know, sometimes we live in the suburban areas where you get the overspill from the major city situation, but we lived in some pretty gritty places. And when you get to New York, that was such an accelerator of that energy. And, you know, that's for me where the energy was. So I loved NWA. I thought they were incredible when they came out, and Public Enemy and Run DMC. Afrika Bambaataa. I love Afrika Bambaataa. Thank you to Malcolm McLaren for that all that.
Sweet Soul Sister, Wake Up Time for Freedom. You know, when you're talking about connecting the past to the present, it seems like, you know, there's a couple tracks right there, different than what we're talking about musically. That's more thematically. Like, do you see those songs speaking to anything specific today?
Well, certainly archetypal elements in the song. I mean, the idea of a city as a feminine entity, you know, Sweet Soul Sister, the idea of the philosophy and revolutionary culture that has emanated from Paris, post-situationism, the love of jazz music, all these incredible elements that were woven together, and this idea that the city has its own essence and that the feminine, very strong feminine energy, and there's a mystique there to that. I think it's a subject I've always been interested in, is exploring, going beyond cognition, you know, the ego's cognition, and moving into much more, essentially based gathering of information where it's intuitive. And some of these things just kind of grow out of an intuition. I couldn't really break it all down. You know, I'm not a quantum physics scientist or anything like that. But there was definitely picking up on the energy and the essences of cities. And also, I guess, cinema, trying to create things that were visceral, visually, create visual, your visual cortex would be, start vibrating with this music as well. And maybe some of the words and the phrases would bring up certain images. But I guess you could link, if you were, you know, clever enough, you could sit back and link a lot of the lines to things that are happening politically and social politically right now in the world. I mean, the idea of Sonic Temple was, for me, was always the idea that, yes, it's entertainment. You pay for a ticket, you go through the door, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a moment when all that kind of fades away, when you hit the stage and you can get this sense, this essence of an anticipation from an audience. And there's an opportunity to do something together that night in this kind of ritual space. And I sometimes say to the audience, like, what have you got to say? Get it out right now. Here's your opportunity. Here's your opportunity to be unfiltered and to let it go. And everybody's safe. Everybody is welcome in this space. We take care of each other in our space. I always want to reiterate that our concerts are open to everyone, any walk of life. We don't segregate in that way. So I think that's kind of woven through the songs. Wake Up Time for Freedom. It's just that's like a Buddhist tenet, you know, wake up. A dream, you know, the form is formless, formlessness is form, you know, a dream within a dream. I was picking up more Buddhist texts through the Beats, through Alan Watts, through Timothy Leary, through Ginsberg, through, Burroughs, through Joseph Campbell, Hero of a Thousand Faces, the interviews he did with Bill Moyer, you know, The Myth of Freedom, Trogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. It was all this incredible esoteric knowledge that was coming through, especially on public television. You know, these great interviews with Bill Moyers, and just becoming more interested in the architects of the subculture. Like, when you actually go, like, yeah, you have your very commercial end with your Woodstocks and all that kind of thing, but you actually look at the individuals who kind of fired this all up. You know, it's like, why do hippies have long hair? Everyone's like, well, you know, they were, like, you know, influenced by Native Americans and that kind of thing. Yes, they were. But one of the big reasons that hippies had long hair is because those dignitaries from Cuba after the revolution went to Berkeley and they were photographed in Life magazine. I think it was like Camilo Cienfuegos and it might have been Che Guevara. They had long hair and beard. And everyone was like, what? They look stunning. You know, and that was a massive picture in Life. And then all of a sudden people start to affect that look on the Berkeley campus, you know, the long hair look and the beard and the beatnik kind of thing. And then that just evolved. It just became a cultural trend. And, you know, so there's so many tributaries and points of, you know, entry points. And I'd like to think that some of those have woven through into our songs. And there are layers, and there are text. There was an intention to try and create something that had layers that could be peeled away, that you could, there's room for discovery in the music, you know, not all of it. Some of it was just pretty blatantly street fight. You know, it was to create an immediate adrenal response. But I think a great amount of travel and thought and consideration went into it. And we didn't always get it right. I mean, it's not, Sonic Temple's imperfect in many ways. It has many imperfections, but it is what it is. And, you know, there it is, the Sonic Polaroid of cult circa 88 through 91. That record, you know, it's created its own space outside of us. That people have, so many people I've met at our shows come up and they share what an important record it was for them in their lives, and that it still evokes certain moods and sentiments when they put it on.
It's absolutely fascinating to hear all of these, as you said at the beginning of the interview, that you wanted to talk about the influences and to hear how many different types of influences all went in to make this record sound what it did. I mean, it's to me, it's just, you know, at its base level, it's a great rock record. But to hear how deep everything goes is really amazing.
Even people like, you know, fucking Brian Jones, you know, when he went to Morocco, and the master musicians of Jujuku, you know, things like that. And then woven into the Beats, Burroughs, and woven into like Dyson and Paul Bowles and the literary crossovers and the, you know, there was just so many. Brian Jones was always a very important figure to me. I always felt that he was, if he'd continued, he would have made some magnificent work. Pink Floyd were a band that I actually saw in 1975, and they were always kind of constantly around, and I never thought of them as an influence, but they've actually been a major part of my life. You know, when I listen to it, I think, how many times have I sat down and listened to Dark Side of the Moon or Animals? I don't know, thousands perhaps, you know, countless. Wish You Were Here, I mean, and you know, At My Heart Mother, so just incredible. And all that goes has found its way through, albeit, you know, through our dilettante fingers, we came out of punk rock. What can we say? I didn't go to a music conservatory. I was self-taught, and, very much like Tom Sachs as an artist. We throw this together, and it somehow manages to create, it connects in some ways, and it's not for everybody, and I wouldn't expect it to be, but hopefully this tour, I mean, it's been an incredible response, because it's selling out. We did the Greek, which was, we did nearly 6,000, I think, the Greek, sold that out. The UK tour selling out, the Canadian tour sold out, which for us, we're kind of going, what? What? I mean, we were doing pretty good before. It was like, we were doing good. We were doing like probably 90% across the board in terms of, packing venues out. But this tour has been, I think, because we set it up as a Sonic Temple, not the Sonic Temple, a Sonic Temple, meaning a Sonic Temple is this place. It's an idea. It requires your participation as much as our performance. Otherwise, it's not going to come off. It just won't come off. So, and then it's like, I'm just viewing it as like a Sonic Temple, an evening with the Cult revealing the DNA of their influences or something like that.
It's exciting. I do want to see one of these shows. I need to come to the
UK. If you really want to see it, the Greek was excellent. But I think that if you really want to see Sonic Temple in contextual environments, London Hammersmith Apollo, as it's called now, mm-hmm. It used to be called the Hammersmith Odeon, where Bowie did Spiders on Mars and Ziggy Stardust, last concert was done there. You know, that's the place to see it, because that venue particularly was a venue that was very important for Billy and I. We used to go out a lot when we first got together, and we'd go see everybody from Johnny Thunders to Iggy Pop to, Susan the Banshees, at the Hammersmith Apollo. Incredible venue. And
when is that show?
It's like October the 25th or something like that.
That's totally doable.
Yeah, that'll be a good one. But there's never any guarantees, you know.
Right.
I mean, I remember walking out on the Hammersmith Odeon one show I did not that long ago, and I ran out stage and my pants ripped open. I was like, oh, shit, you're kidding me. Just into the first song, I actually literally had to run off the stage and find another pair of trousers. And the only trousers I had, other than my stage pants, at the time that I could find were like a pair of like, drop crotch sweatpants. And I ran out and people were like, what is he wearing? And people actually commented like, he looked terrible. He was like dressed in his casual clothes. And it's like, needless to they know that my ass was hanging out.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
But that really affected the show, not having the right trousers. You have to write trousers.
Quick note here that I just noticed, by the way, the Doors, because we talked about them so much, a little side note to the interview here. Today is the 50th anniversary of the Soft Parade.
Fantastic. Yes, the monk bought lunch.
The great line. The great line.
What an incredible line. Amazing line. The monk bought lunch. Yeah. What? That's an incredible record.
It's best part of the trip.
Part of the trip, yeah.
This has been so much fun. Cool. Thank you so much for taking the moment, time today.
Thank you, sir.
All right. We'll see you around.
We'll see you down the road somewhere.
All right.
Take care.
And my thanks to Ian Astbury. The new album from the Cult is called Under the Midnight Sun. And thanks to you for checking out the episode. Before you get out, please, again, hit that subscribe button so you can catch all the interviews that I send out every week, new and every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, to keep you up to date on your favorite artists and discover some new ones at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, at Spotify, Podchaser, NPR, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcasts from. Subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Then after that, head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern. An hour full of song premieres, music news, anniversary spins, bonus interviews, Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. Of course, you can also catch me on the social media spots, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all three of them. The address is at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow along. That does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Take care, bye-bye.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.